You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Farah. Coming up, we'll talk about threats facing rural hospitals and how repealing the Affordable Care Act might impact health care in rural communities.
First, President Donald Trump signed an executive order to withdraw the U.S. from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, today. The move follows his promise on the campaign trail to undo the TPP and renegotiate trade policy.
The trade deal was negotiated by former President Obama's administration and got criticism from both sides of the aisle, but it was also seen as a way to connect the U.S. with some of the fastest-growing economies of Asia.
Mark Koplovich joins us now. He's an associate professor of political science and public affairs at UW-Madison. Mark, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, Mark, what exactly does the executive order to withdraw from the Trans-Pacific Partnership change starting today?
Well, so it effectively removes the U.S. signature from the TPP. The TPP is an agreement between 12 countries signed last year that make up about 40% of the world economy. So it's the U.S., but it was also Mexico, Japan, South Korea, Vietnam, et cetera. And it effectively means that the TPP is now dead because you needed 85% of the economic output of those countries and six of the signatories to ratify it. So if you take the U.S. or the Japan out of it, effectively the agreement is no longer going to be ratified and put in force.
Well, speaking of ratified, it was never ratified by the U.S. Congress. So what did that mean about it?
It's a controversial agreement, as most trade agreements are, because trade has huge distributional consequences. Right. The general idea with trade is trade increases aggregate welfare or the national wealth of a country and its trading partners. There's more goods going across borders. The prices go down. The problem is there are winners and losers within countries. Right. And so in the U.S., we might be importing more goods from overseas, and that might cause some firms or people to go out of business, people to lose their jobs. And the problem with trade agreements is these things are bundled together. You can't get the increased benefits for consumers without the domestic distributional consequences.
President Trump made it a priority to withdraw just a day or two into office. What message do you think that sends to U.S. trade partners, both in the TPP and beyond?
Yeah. I think it's a very clear signal of Trump's mercantilist trade policy, right? He very much views trade not, as I was describing, as a positive-sum game, which is really the way we viewed trade since the time of Adam Smith in the 18th century, but as a zero-sum game, right, where if one country is winning, the other is losing, right? And the idea, I think, with Trump's trade policy and his foreign policy more broadly is putting America first, which means backing out of international commitments, closing off from the world economy. That may help save jobs in certain sectors at home, but in terms of is that good for American consumers and overall wealth for the U.S.? Not necessarily. And it certainly sends a signal to our allies that the U.S. may not be the main partner, main economic and geopolitical partner on the international stage in the future. So most of the criticism has been on a couple issues. So one was there's a dispute settlement court, an investor state dispute settlement court that's part of the TPP or was supposed to be part of the TPP. There were concerns about a loss of American sovereignty, that foreign investors could sue the U.S. There were concerns also about whether reciprocal reductions were going to happen, whether the U.S. was going to lower its barriers, but whether other countries would live up to their commitments to lower their trade barriers. So there were a lot of criticisms, but on the other hand, the U.S. probably stood to be the largest beneficiary from this agreement. We're the largest economy in the world. We were going to open up access to our markets, but we were also going to get greater access to markets like Japan and Australia and South Korea. So again, you see these distributional consequences. A lot of the criticism in the U.S. is saying that certain workers are going to lose their jobs or certain sectors are going to be hurt. But we haven't heard much in the political debate about the consumer side, right, and the sort of overall benefits for the U.S. as an economy.
What about the criticism that trade deals like the TPP may bring more wealth to the country, but it may concentrate that wealth in corporate hands?
That is a concern. The estimates that I've seen are that actually the benefits of inequality, the cost of rising inequality, were not going to be due to the TPP. In fact, there's some very interesting research out now by Jason Furman and others that tariffs, taxes on imports, are actually regressive taxes, right? That is, they hit lower-income households harder. Most of the tariffs that we're talking about getting rid of in TPP and other trade agreements are on consumer goods, right? And that's a larger share of income for lower-income households. So the argument that trade is linked to inequality, over the long run, there's a lot of evidence, specifically with this agreement. It's not clear to me that that was going to be the case.
Mark Koplovich is with us right now, an associate professor of political science and public affairs at UW-Madison, talking about President Trump signing an executive order today to withdraw the United States from the TPP. And Mark, what do you think that withdrawal from the United States, by the United States, could mean for a country like China who might be looking to step in?
Yeah, so the big concern, I think, beyond the trade is issues is the geopolitical issues. Right. As much as TPP was a trade agreement, it was also very clearly a part of the Obama administration's pivot to Asia geopolitically. And one way to think about it is China wasn't involved in this large group, and we were sort of ring-fencing them with all of the other countries around the Pacific Rim. At the same time, we were signing military agreements with India, Australia, et cetera, and again, sort of ring-fencing China geopolitically. So pulling back, I think, is sending a big signal to the world that the U.S., at least under the Trump administration, may be abandoning its role as the global hegemon or the global leader and the champion of a kind of rules-based set of international institutions. And there's even some evidence already we're hearing that countries like Australia and Mexico are now thinking about, as an alternative, we need to move closer to China and maybe sign a bilateral or multilateral agreements with China. So there's a power vacuum possibly in the Pacific, and you could imagine that the Chinese, which are heavily dependent on exports as part of their growth and development model, may step into that power vacuum. Right? They've already done that on the development side by establishing an Asian infrastructure and investment bank as a competitor to the World Bank. And you can imagine that over the next couple of years now, they may try and set up their own alternative TPP-style agreement where the ring fencing would be of the U.S. rather than us being part of the agreement.
And Donald Trump says he's more interested in pursuing bilateral trade agreements instead of the multilateral. How might that policy, that kind of policy, affect the United States, economically speaking?
So it's not necessarily a bad strategy in and of itself. I mean, the U.S. has, and other countries have, a lot of bilateral trade agreements. The problem is a lot of international trade is now trade through multinational corporations, and it's going across multiple borders, right? So trade is not just between the U.S. and Canada or the U.S. and Australia. You have multinational corporations operating in all of these countries. And, yeah, a lot of the things that were in the TPP were actually about harmonizing things like labor standards and environmental regulations and having a court to adjudicate types of investment disputes and trade disputes between these partners. So it's not clear that a bilateral agreement can fully substitute for that sort of multilateral architecture.
Now, there are also signals that Trump will revisit the North American Free Trade Alliance. And is his approach to the TPP, do you think, going to be any indication to how he'll approach NAFTA?
It's hard to know what's going to happen with that. One way to think about the TPP was it was basically taking NAFTA and extending it to 10 other countries, right, or 9 other countries, because Mexico and Canada are the partners in NAFTA. They were going to be part of the TPP. And the idea with the TPP was we were going to extend the free trade agreement to those 9 other countries, and we were going to have this deeper cooperation on things like regulatory harmonization and investment disputes. So if we just turn back to renegotiating NAFTA, first, it's not clear that Canada and Mexico want to renegotiate NAFTA, right? And the second thing is, again, a lot of the international trade now is not going just between Canada, Mexico, and the U.S., but also involves these other partners. So it's sort of an incomplete substitute. But I think you see the sort of same thing of the Trump administration is signaling that our trade commitments, with questioning our commitment to NATO and saying our military allies aren't paying enough, there's a very strong signal that we're going to rethink our role in the world and maybe our commitment to all of these international agreements and our allies.
Mark, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That was Mark Koplovich. He's an associate professor of political science and public affairs at UW-Madison. After President Trump signed an executive order withdrawing the U.S. from the TPP, he joined us to talk about some of the implications that particular move could have. According to a report from Kaiser Health News, more than 70 hospitals in rural areas in the U.S. have closed in the past 6 years. And according to our next guest, a repeal of the Affordable Care Act could possibly lead to more closings and healthcare shortcomings in rural areas.
Joining us now is Jared Keller, a contributing editor at Pacific Standard Magazine, where he's written about this issue. Jared, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with this report from Kaiser Health News you cited in your reporting. Tell us about some of the recent trends of difficulties at rural hospitals and closings of some around the country.
So rural hospitals around the country, which are they're an essential organ for Americans who don't live in densely populated and primarily urban areas. They provide health care and really critical resources to around 62 million Americans in often poor rural communities. And in the last decade or so, even with the the passage of the Affordable Care Act, they faced major declines just based on funding. The way in which the Affordable Care Act sort of diminished this decline and sort of staved off a rapid decline in these essential community health centers was by providing extra funding through a Medicare expansion. Through Medicaid expansion, rather. Without that, we're going to see rural hospitals continue to close at a rapid rate. I believe that nearly 700 are at risk currently, which is almost half of the number that meet the needs of those 62 million Americans.
Yeah, talk some more about how the Affordable Care Act may have been propping up some of these at-risk rural facilities, partly by funding the patients who go to them to be able to pay for it. Were there other parts of it?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, the ACA's 340B drug discount plan would provided more than 1,100 facilities with access to critical medications at a greatly reduced cost. But it wasn't just an issue of medications and an issue of what's actually available under the health insurance plans of those rural Americans. More a matter of physical plan. The additional funding would have allowed for upgrades to facilities, changes in operational procedure, better funding for essential technology like a CAT scan or an MRI. And those affect everyone, regardless of whether they've been able to take advantage of the benefits of the ACA or not. It's sort of the infrastructure of healthcare in these rural areas. And, you know, in order to really understand the significance of this is that if one rural hospital closes, that's maybe a couple extra hours drive for someone who doesn't live in a densely packed urban area. It affects everyone, regardless of whether they personally have benefited from state and federal exchanges or not.
Right. If an urban hospital closes, that's a problem, but there might be other options nearby. In a lot of rural areas, as I understand it, this might be the only game in town.
Exactly.
And in your article, you point to some other reporting out there about what happened in West Virginia when people in working class communities kind of embraced the Affordable Care Act and the funding that it provided. What happened there?
Yeah, you know, the example you're citing is described by The Atlantic's Dan Newkirk, who did a great job describing this in an article. And he talks about how in sort of the coal miner country of Appalachia, the Affordable Care Act became essential in shoring up these collapsing rural health care systems. As you probably know, you know, coal miners or blue-collar workers in rural areas tend to face much higher risk of obesity, of cancer, of lung issues, of circulatory issues, primarily because of the nature of their work. For West Virginia, it became a question of actually embracing what was politically seen as a very unpopular program, the expansion of a state exchange. And it ended up benefiting a significant portion of the population. People had to put sort of their political preconceived notions aside and actually look at the direct benefits they're receiving.
Talking to Jared Keller about a piece he wrote for Pacific Standard, looking at rural hospitals, key part of the healthcare systems in rural areas. A lot of them dealing with financial problems. 70 have closed in the last 6 years or so. And some reports find they may be more at risk after the repeal of the Affordable Care Act, which has provided some support for those hospitals. By the way, if this is an important part of your community, you can tweet us at Central Time WPR or send us a message on the Central Time Facebook page. And Jared, in your piece, you're making the case that, we saw in the elections this last year, rural voters turning out for Republicans, people who supported Affordable Care Act repeal, maybe ultimately hurting their own healthcare futures. You were making the case there.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I mean, there's a little bit of a trend of people who on paper are voting against their own interests. But in the case of rural hospitals, it sort of makes sense why that's not an immediately apparent risk. And while, you know, the rural hospital really is sort of the lifeblood of a rural community, you know, often people are thinking about their health insurance and their general healthcare infrastructure in terms of how much they have to pay in premiums a month. So while they're, you know, taking that into account, they're not necessarily seeing the damage that they're doing to a just sort of a public health option that really affects everyone, regardless of their insurance standing.
And rural hospitals, I imagine this is true for a lot of hospitals in general, as I understand it, have pretty tight margins. There's not a lot of wiggle room in their budgets.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I mean, they're extremely fragile. I mean, they're constantly at risk. I mean, as I believe that there are around 2,000 that really provide access to healthcare options for those 62 million Americans. And while the ACA Medicaid expansion would have benefited, or the 340B drug program would have benefited maybe around half of them, you know, 700 hospitals remain at risk, and they could simply just drop off the face of the earth at any given moment.
And the Republican goal for at least a lot of Republicans in Congress has said we're going to repeal and replace. Do you think this issue of rural health care and rural hospitals is getting enough attention as that replace part is starting to be talked about?
I think to a certain extent. You know, based on President Trump's plan to replace the Affordable Care Act from sort of federal funding to block grants for states, sort of recognizes that states are really benefiting in terms of their healthcare infrastructure from Medicaid expansion. And the question really becomes whether it's the federal government or whether it's state governments that are making these assessments. So I think sort of the back of Republican lawmakers had, they recognize that they can't simply, you know, starve the beast, because they'll end up starving their own constituents. Whether this actually plays out in the coming months is anyone's guess.
All right, Jared, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
We just talked to Jared Keller, contributing editor at Pacific Standard Magazine, looking at the closing of rural hospitals and how repealing the Affordable Care Act may impact this trend. On Saturday, hundreds of thousands of women from around the country converged on the nation's capital for the Women's March on Washington. Speakers and performers rallied near the Capitol before marchers made their way toward the White House. Some observers called it a counter-inauguration.
There were similar marches in cities around the country at the same time. A sister march webpage estimates 2.6 million people took part in 673 marches in all 50 states and in 32 countries. Here's a sample of some of the chants heard in Washington, D.C.
Hey, hey!
We want to hear from you on this at 800-642-1234. Did you attend the Women's March on Washington? Did you attend one of the other rallies, maybe closer to home? What was that experience like? Why did you go? And if you didn't go to one of these rallies, as an observer, seeing what went on in the media, what's your reaction? You can join in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll be joined by our guest in just a bit, but let's hear from you now at 800-642-1234. Tell us about your experiences. Did you follow this effort? What did you think of it? If you didn't agree with it, why not? What do you think would be a better approach? 800-642-1234. And Lori is with us first in Madison. Lori, hi.
Hi.
And Lori, tell us about your story.
Well, I attended with my daughter at the march here in Madison, and we were ready to be impressed that if it was 10,000 people showing up. So the actual report that 75,000 or 100,000 showed up was amazing. And I was really impressed with how friendly the crowd was and that there were no reports of any trouble with the police at all. It was really a fun experience. I don't agree with all the issues that everybody brought to the march, but I felt like it was important to focus on the things that we agree on, that everyone deserves respect and everyone deserves to have their voice heard.
And Lori, had you been to a protest march like this before?
nothing, well, nothing on this scale, nothing so huge. I actually didn't get to march at all because by the time I got there, the streets were completely filled with people and we didn't move. We couldn't move from our spot.
Okay, Lori, thank you for sharing your experience. Appreciate that. Lori saying she didn't agree with all of the issues being represented at the march, but agreed on some fundamentals, she says. And we'll go next to Mary joining us in Milwaukee. Mary, hi.
Hi.
Hi, what was your experience with the march?
Yeah, I was at the march on D.C., and I thought it was a really awesome display of intersectional feminism because so many of the speakers didn't just talk about reproductive rights, which is probably what people usually think of when they think about modern-day feminism, but they talked about Kamala Harris was there, for example, and she talked about how the economy is a woman's issue and national security and all of these issues that we face are all women's issues because we are all citizens. So it's not just about one issue that we should try to tackle, but there's a whole group of us with lots of different focuses, and I really appreciated that at the march and getting to march with all different kinds of people with all different kinds of views and talents.
And Mary, you said there were a lot of different focuses at the march. Do you see that as a potential weakness for those looking to start a political movement, that there is a lot of widespread interest in different areas and there might not be a single focus?
I personally don't see that as a weakness. I think I can see how someone would, but I think that is actually a strength because it means that there's no issue that we can't get involved with and no issue that we shouldn't have a voice in.
Mary, thank you so much for calling and sharing your experience at the march in Washington. And we're going to go next to Cindy joining us in Appleton as we talk about last Saturday's Women's March. There was a march in Wisconsin, in Madison, Milwaukee, and, of course, in different cities around the country and around the world and in 32 countries. And you can call us, share your experience at 800-642-1234. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. Cindy, hi. You're on the air.
Hello. Well, I was also a participant in Madison, and I did get to march. I walked towards the library mall and didn't get very far, so turned around, and we all started coming back the other direction. But numbers were impressive. Like the lady said, it was a very respectful and nice crowd, and I was there protesting the resistance movement. I am anti-Trump, did not vote for him, would not vote for him. He's not my president, and it's going to be a long 4 years.
Cindy, one critique that we've seen come in comments as we prepared for this this interview today was that maybe there wasn't a lot of diversity in the crowd in Madison. Did you see that? And if so, did that bother you?
Oh, what do you mean by diversity? There was lots of diversity as far as I was concerned there.
Okay. Well, Cindy, thank you for that. Appreciate you calling and sharing that. And we'll go next to our guest, Jessica Hughes, is with us now. She's co-organizer of the Women's March on Washington, Wisconsin. So she was at the march in Washington with a group from Wisconsin. And Jessica, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Jessica, we're getting a head start hearing about different experiences from women who marched both in Washington and closer to home here in Wisconsin. You were in Washington. What was your experience like on Saturday?
I mean, it was incredible. There was just a sea of people. We filled the entire march route. And the entire just energy of the crowd was so positive and so excited. And I'm sure you've heard already, you know, it was, I think, the largest protest now in U.S. history and not a single arrest. So that really says something about kind of the mentality of the people who were there.
How big was the Wisconsin contingent that you were traveling with?
So the buses that they sent down, as far as we know, sent around 500, but we aren't even sure as far as the women who took trains or took planes. I myself took a car down. So we think we sent around 2,000 to 3,000 women from Wisconsin, all told.
And Jessica, this is a big effort to get from Wisconsin to Washington, D.C. The logistics were there. There were big crowds. What motivated you to take that effort into March?
I mean, I think a lot of us are probably saying the same thing. You know, this definitely was never an anti-Trump march, but it would be disingenuous to say that this election didn't influence the desire to be active in some way. But for myself personally, I really wanted to send a message to the city members of Congress that we are numbers too large to ignore, and that to ignore women's rights is really, like Hillary Clinton said, to ignore human's rights.
Now, did you get the sense, speaking to women who were there, maybe women who didn't come with your group, that there were people there who were newly political active, or was this a group of people who were used to being engaged?
Oh, no. It was such an interesting mix of people who had a lot of experience being activists and so many people for whom this was the first time they'd ever done anything like this. In fact, one of the major organizers for the march itself, Bob Land, had never been involved in any kind of activism or organization for protests before in the past, had just sort of stepped into it.
And there were a lot of speakers at that Washington, D.C. march on Saturday. We've got a clip here from actress America Ferrara.
A platform of hate and division assumed power yesterday. But the president is not America. His cabinet is not America. Congress is not America. We are America. And we are here to stay.
A clip from the march in Washington this past Saturday from actress America Ferrara. And Jessica, what are some of the issues brought up by other speakers that day?
There was definitely a pretty broad range of issues. Scarlett Johansson spoke very eloquently about some experiences that she's had being able to access reproductive health care, and she expressed some fears that she has about her own daughter not being able to have the same access to those rights. Madonna spoke very colorfully about some of her concerns about this administration not being willing to hear us and not recognizing that we need to have a broader viewpoint, especially in our government. There were a lot of really impressive speakers. They spoke about the Black Lives Matter movement, certainly about concerns over claims that we would be deporting people, that we would be separating families. So, yeah, there was definitely a broad range of viewpoints.
Before we dive into some calls, I want to ask you just briefly, we have a comment here from Kristen, who traveled to Washington, D.C. from Madison to participate in the march. And she said she had a positive experience marching, but she had some reservations. And she said, quote, "My fear is that a lot of women who marched are feeling self-congratulatory and have a sense of, yay, we did it, but that the real work is just beginning. We need to be organized and leave no one out." Do you think that the organizers and the people who participated are doing what they need to do if this is their goal to channel this into political movement?
I certainly know that I heard at the march people were already saying, okay, what do we do tomorrow? What do we do next week? You know, it's not enough to just stand here for one day and then go home. I can't speak to some of the other states, but as far as our group goes, the Women's March on Washington, Wisconsin Facebook page is already transitioning to a women's action page that's intended to support women and primarily women of color entering into positions in government and helping us to be more organized as far as contacting our already elected government officials and really trying to influence that policy in a way that supports and protects what we believe in.
We're talking with Jessica Hughes now, one of the co-organizers for the Women's March on Washington, Wisconsin.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you attend one of these marches over the weekend? What was your experience like? Why did you do it? If you didn't take part, what do you think about the march? What impact, if any, it might have? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're picking up our conversation now about the Women's March on Washington this past Saturday with Jessica Hughes. She's a co-organizer of the group of women who traveled from Wisconsin for the march.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you travel to Washington, D.C. for the march this weekend? Did you participate in one of the marches closer to home? Why? What did you think of it? And if you're looking at it from the outside, what do you think of this? Is this a one-off? Is this unfair to the new administration? Do you think only time will tell? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go back to our callers now. We've got Maureen joining us next in Oconomowoc. Maureen, hi.
Hi there.
What was your story?
Thank you for having me on your show.
Sure. What did you want to share?
Well, I'd like to share, I have never attended a protest like this before, and I felt that the issues were so frontline that I needed to do it. And so I joined in taking a bus with women from Congregation Shalom out of Milwaukee, out of River Hills, actually. And we took a bus to D.C. and participated in the rally and the march. And it was something I can't explain to anyone who wasn't there, the sheer number, the sheer just emotion. It was palpable. And it wasn't all bashing Trump. It was standing up for women's rights, immigrant rights, Black Lives Matter, Muslims. And I thought the diversity that I saw as well is something I need to comment on. It was a lot of men and children, women of all ages. It was spectacular. I can get tears in my eyes just thinking about it. I'm so glad I attended.
Maureen, I want to ask you, now that Saturday is over, are you clear on what comes next, or are you planning to take any steps that you might not have been planning to take if you hadn't gone?
Absolutely. I think one of the main issues that we talked about, Gloria Steinem touched on it, Michael Moore, Ashley Judd, is that this is just the beginning. I've already called my congressman today. I've got postcards going out in the mail. I have joined several groups, one of them called Citizens Action, and I intend on being extremely active going forward from here. This is not the end. This is just the beginning, and we are going to build a momentum like you've never seen before.
Maureen, thank you so much for your call and for your description of the event for you. And Jessica, Maureen's saying she's never been to an event like this, got tears in her eyes, and says she's got some solid action going forward. Do you see this as the start of something which could be called a movement at this point already?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that just really sums it up right there. We were all inspired. I think every single person who was there could tell you something they saw that they never expected. You know, Maureen kind of touched on seeing a more diverse crowd than maybe she was expecting. I had the same reaction. I thought we would see a handful of men in the crowd. I thought they would make up a pretty small percentage. I would say at least a third of the people who were there, if not more, were men. And that's so inspiring to me that this is not just a single issue movement. This is something that really touches for so many of us, maybe all of us.
Now, some other big movements like Occupy Wall Street had trouble turning those protest movements into political goals that were achievable. Do you worry at all about the same thing with the Women's March?
You know, I certainly think that that's always a potential when you bring together people who have really diverse viewpoints and have different issues that they want to see highlighted or pushed to the forefront. But I do believe that so many of us walked away with that mentality of we have to do more. And we saw what we were able to achieve as a group. And I think as long as we can hold on to that mentality of power in numbers, we can agree on a consensus and really work to move issues forward together.
Well, Maureen, again, thank you for the call. And we're going to move next to Ruth joining us in Madison. Ruth, hi.
Hi. I was up at the Women's March in Bayfield up on Lake Superior.
And what was your experience like there?
Well, it was just wonderful. You know, I've been hearing reports from all over the country about tens of thousands, but I felt like I wanted to call to say even the rural areas were having marches in their own way. And so in Bayfield, we marched. If anyone knows that beautiful town on Lake Superior, we marched from the Rittenhouse Inn down to Lake Superior and had prayers there from Ojibwe Sisters about protecting the water. And there were lots of kids there and men and really positive, happy march.
Ruth, thank you for that. Ruth painting a picture of what she experienced in Bayfield, Wisconsin, as marches took place all over the country and in 32 countries, as a matter of fact. And what did you hear, Jessica, about the experience from women who stayed in Wisconsin?
We have gotten some amazing posts on our Facebook page from people who stayed in Wisconsin, not just those women that went to the Madison March, which I don't know if you've gotten a chance to speak to anyone from there, but they were anticipating 4,000 or 5,000. And from what I hear, they had closer to 100,000, which really shows you what a nerve this is touching. Yeah, she was talking about the group that she organized with. Fort Atkinson posted for us that they expected around 40 to 50 people. They got 200 in the rain, in the cold. I mean, there have been so many people that stayed, like she said, in those rural areas and still stood up and made their presence known.
We're talking with Jessica Hughes right now, co-organizer of the Women's March on Washington, Wisconsin. And we're hearing from you at 800-642-1234. If you participated, what you thought of it. A comment here, Jessica, from Edward on Facebook, who says, it's a useless waste of energy. He's president now, not to mention how the entire feminist movement is a farce and there was no violence claim is a lie. So a few points there Edward is disagreeing on. He says there was violence and this is a waste of time. What do you say to that?
I mean, I guess I would have some questions about what violence he was hearing about. You know, I can say I was part of that crowd. I showed up at 8 o'clock in the morning. I didn't leave until 6 o'clock at night. I didn't see any violence. I didn't hear of any violence. So I know that there were no reported arrests. As far as it being a waste of energy, I think our founding fathers understood how important it is if you want to sustain a democracy, if you want a democracy to endure for hundreds upon hundreds of years, you have to allow for dissent. You have to allow for people to share viewpoints that aren't necessarily in line with the party or the people in power. And they understood that that really brings vitality and life back into a government. So I would argue that by standing up and making our viewpoints known, we are, I think, the opposite of wasting our energy. We are using our energy to our best efforts. And I mean, feminism is a farce. I'm a young woman, and I can rent an apartment, and I can rent a car, and I can do so many things that my mother couldn't do at my age without the signature of her husband or her father. So I would think that feminism is probably a little bit more real than a farce.
And let's take another caller now here. Robert joins us in Rhinelander. Robert, hi.
Yeah, hi. I attended the can you hear me okay?
Yep. You sound great.
Yeah, I attended the march up in Minocqua, and it was raining heavily, and I went up there thinking there might be 40 or 50 people, and there were over 330 people, and half of them were men. And
wow.
I just want to say that it was more of a collective show, in that showing respect for women is great for the culture. It was a very positive atmosphere. Really supported by the community. And it was a great event, and I think it's a great step forward in keeping our administration honest and open. And people just need to get involved.
Robert, thank you for that call. And as we start to wrap up, Jessica, if the Women's March in Wisconsin and in different states around the world was a message on day one after Donald Trump was sworn in as president, how would you articulate that message? What is it?
Wow, that's such a great question. I think I would say this. There were a lot of claims made about making America great again. I think one could make the argument that America was pretty great to begin with. But more than that, I think if you really want to hold to that promise, then you need to commit yourself to bringing together all Americans. You need to be open to different viewpoints, and you need to try and keep the people as involved in that process as you can. Certainly, I'm a little concerned that we're a few days into the administration and we're already seeing a lot of executive action happening, and I think that should certainly say something to you that maybe he's not as focused on bringing America together as he might have said.
Jessica, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Jessica Hughes, co-organizer of the Women's March on Washington, Wisconsin. And you can keep sharing your thoughts and your march experiences over on the Central Time Facebook page. Just search Central Time on WPR on Facebook.